Talk Shoe.
Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of Review Less, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bites. We're alongside the Honorable Judge John Facciola, recently retired from the U.S. Magistrate Judicial position for the U.S. District Court in the District of Columbia. We're going to attempt to offer information, insights, and ideas about e-discovery innovation from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available whenever you're interested in downloading it, hitting your play button on your iPad, iPod, computer, wherever you listen to this. Today I think we have a real interesting show. I love the title, which I didn't come up with. We'll reference that in a minute, but it's Big Data, Dark Data, and the Criminal Internet, eDiscovery's Next Frontiers. And we're going to talk to our three guests about this topic, which, frankly, to me, sounds more like a Marvel Comics headline, you know, or a movie than a topic in eDiscovery, which already has my attention. But you know, dark data, for the listeners, is basically data which exists but isn't used. And in the context of e-discovery, first of all, in the context of the real world with companies, some companies capture data, and it sits there on the servers, and it never gets used. It's somehow built into the system, and it sits there and like a silent asset, or worse, a risk waiting for someone else to uncover and then use. But in e-discovery, dark data can take on a different meaning. It's the data which companies might be using, but which the e-discovery tools miss because they're not engineered to understand more complex relationships between different pieces of data. So this is a topic I don't think many people have covered. We love doing that at ESI Bites. It's very entrepreneurial. And our participants for this really interesting show are, you know, of course, my co-host, Judge Facciola, who's well-known in the field for his thought-provoking opinions and the speaking he's done nationally on e-discovery. And Judge Facciola has been a mentor for so many in the field of e-discovery and is active in education at Georgetown. We have a first-time guest, Gordon Calhoun, who's a partner at Lewis Brisbo based in Los Angeles, a large law firm in many, many cities across the country, and he heads their e-discovery department. Gordon frequently speaks on e-discovery topics. Personally, I have found he's equally strong and conversant with talking about technology or talking about legal principles, which is a unique attribute in the legal community, and I'm thrilled we finally got him on a program. Sean Byrne is head of eDiscovery at Nuix, a processing software application which is widely used in the field. Sean's based in Chicago. We go way back in eDiscovery personally. He's also co-chair of the Seventh Circuit eDiscovery Pilot Program Technology Utilization Committee, and it's long overdue that we've had Sean on one of these shows. And then another first-time guest, also out on the West Coast, Jacques Nocknug, who's the president, founder, and chief scientist of JNN Group. They're based in L.A. I would say, Jacques, you're the resident geek on the show. And, you know, while this may not have much to do with dark data, Jacques, I've always found it amazing, is fluent in five languages, which has nothing to do with e-discovery, but really shows he's a pretty smart guy. And I've known him for a number of years, and he generally seems to have his eye on issues in the industry well before the industry realizes the impending problems. So this is a great topic for Jacques to be involved in. So
Carl,
with that in mind,
way,
go ahead.
Carl, by the way, do you know what you call a person who only speaks one language?
Carl Shinneman.
an American.
Yeah, there you go. But I will tell you, I have traveled to all over the world and four continents, and I have found that I can order beer in a bar in any country in the world. It works. You know, English works. But anyway, so let's start the show. And Gordon, you get credit for naming the show. So what is dark data in e-discovery, and why is it a problem? And what does the criminal internet have to do with it? And can Spider-Man or the Incredible Hulk save us from all this?
Well, it's a mouthful to start off with, Carl, but I think we also omitted big data. I'll start with big data. This is becoming an increasing problem. People are identifying about five V's now to describe big data: volume, variety, velocity, variability, and veracity. And really, the biggest immediate problem for e-discovery is variety. This is because our search tools, our review tools, are all text-based. As of this year, it's expected that more than 50% of interpersonal communication will occur by video or other non-text forms. Within 5 years, the internet is expected to be 80% video. We don't have tools to analyze that, and if we're lawyers looking for evidence and the majority of the potentially relevant data is inaccessible, but because our tools are blind to it, we have a real issue. Volume is also a significant problem because our tools are, for the most part, SQL or Oracle-based backends, which are increasingly incompatible with the volume of data in non-SQL environments. Certainly, the marketing departments and research departments of major corporations are already in that space, using different languages than we as lawyers who are in a Microsoft world typically use. Velocity is another problem we have with the back end of most of our tools. And I know that our friends at Relativity and some others are using Solr and other non-SQL back ends on their most recent iterations, but the APIs connecting the back end, the other operational features in those tools are still SQL-based. So we have a real technology crunch that's coming upon us, and the only good news with people I've spoken with about the issue is we lawyers are living life in a rearview mirror. We fight over issues that arose 2 or 3 or 4 years ago. So the technology that we play with is not necessarily cutting edge, and we don't have to be quite as adept and nimble at using the newest technologies as our business counterparts have to be, but it's a push that's coming upon us very rapidly. In terms of dark data, there's obviously the information about which you spoke earlier, Carl, the information resident on servers that's not readily accessible. But we also have things like the dark net, dark internet, which are potentially very valuable sources of evidence. To get a sense of what that is, the dark net overlay network, it can only be accessed by software configurations or authorizations, and they typically use non-standard communication protocol and ports. Two types of dark net information that we're particularly concerned about are peer-to-peer or friend-to-friend sources of exchange of information, and also the anonymous networks such as Tor, which allow for anonymous communications between parties, and this is where the criminal internet, for example, resides. And to get a sense of what the magnitude of the issues are there, current estimates are that only 0.03% of internet data is accessible through what we look at as the clear internet, the one that's accessible through Google, Yahoo, and other forms of search tools. And the fact that we have so much data out there, data that's used and communicated between people who may be engaging in untoward activity beneath the surface of clear internet, suggests that we as lawyers have places we ought to be looking. And just as a practical matter, on the dark net, where the criminal enterprises work and buy and sell identities, one of the issues that plaintiffs' attorneys have had in data breach litigation is the absence of demonstrable injury, monetary injury. I would suggest that if we look at personally identifiable information communicated on the internet, the way Yahoo, Google, Facebook, and others look at it, there is monetary value in information about the identity of each person. And even if those people are not having their credit cards misused and the ensuing obligation charged back to them, they are having their personally identifiable information compromised, a set of information which has monetized value. And certainly when you go on Google, Facebook, or Yahoo, you are in effect giving an implied license to the operators of those sites to use that data. There's no such implied license. So, Mr. appropriates that information and offers it for sale. In a conventional approach to things, to issues, misappropriation of identity is a common law recognized tort. These are cases where identities have been misappropriated. They're monetized. They're offered for sale on the dark internet. The fact that a sale is not made is not determinative in a brick-and-mortar world of whether a violation occurred for which recompense is due. And we're probably looking at a situation where those analogies ought to be extended to the virtual world. What we have to do is begin understanding where all this data lives, recognizing that conventional web crawlers don't help us access this information, and also realize from a legal perspective that California, as of 2010, it was a ineffective representation of counsel to fail to Google in a criminal case. So it's not a far stretch to realize that failing to recognize where these sources where these underground sources may have relevant data to your case, failing to think about them, failing to engage someone like Jacques to help you access them, may be a failure to conform to the expected standard of care. To know that there are over 99.9% of the potentially relevant data about a case sitting out there that's inaccessible to you when you simply go on the surface internet is a problem for all of us. And in terms of will Spider-Man or the Incredible Hulk help us? I'll let Jock address Spider-Man, but as far as I'm concerned, the Incredible Hulk is predictive coding algorithms, which will allow us to crunch data in ways that haven't been done before and sift through only the most relevant evidence, so that when we talk about proportionality, we can talk about skimming the cream off the top of these various data sets. So instead of going deep into relatively few data sets, we'll have the ability to go broadly across a wide variety of data sets, including those that might be most interesting, such as peer-to-peer sharing sites in a situation where an employee is leaving and transmitting trade secrets, not through the conventional internet, but through a darknet portal. So those are the kind of questions that we have to be thinking about, and I'll throw it open to everyone else now to talk about those concepts.
Yeah, I just want to add, I asked this question at Legal Tech, which I thought was fantastic a couple days ago on a panel which Judge Facciola happened to be on. There were a couple of other very smart lawyers, and I accidentally asked the in-house lawyer instead of the technologist this question. He looked like a deer in headlights, and I apologize. Gordon, I think you would have given him a heart attack if you had thrown all this stuff into the question. So, Chuck, did you want to take on Spider-Man here?
Yeah. I'll try to chime in. I think it was a wonderful introduction by Gordon. So, Gordon introduced the four V's: variety, volume, velocity, among other things. I want to kind of step back a little bit and compare and kind of describe why this dark data is so much more difficult to grasp than what we're dealing with right now. The problem around e-discovery is really a search problem, trying to find the documents that are the target of our search, finding those documents. The playing field so far, the document corpus that we're looking at, generally emails, documents, and so forth, are more or less the same. They have very common metadata field, and they come for more or less the same kind of systems. In a sense, they are very similar type of data sets. When we think about dark data, we're moving beyond that very concept of data. The first thing to think about is multivariate. In the dark data world, multivariate takes an entirely different dimension. For instance, the variables and attributes that describe a Google transaction are very different than those that describe a credit card transaction or the information stored on your Fitbit or your Apple Watch. and to really be able to mine all this information in a meaningful way requires a different type of structure and a different kinds of way to look at your data. So that's the first and the biggest challenge compared to how we are, the data we're looking at right now and how we've been accessing that data. So we have to be able to find causality. We have to be able to find relationship between those very disparate and very different kinds of data. And we have to show it in a way that it integrates with the evidence and continues to tell the story. So it's a very, very big challenge. I like to joke sometimes that, you know, Google is what now, 15 years old, barely a teenager. So dark data and information, the large information in general, are presenting the kind of problems that really no one around the world has come up with a solution to. I mean, Google is working on dark data, big data. It's just so are all the big organizations and governments right now. So we don't really have a lot of tools to deal with the data as it is. And that's one of the things that wanted to add on here. Finally, content, you know, the information that when we're talking about data, we're really looking at the content of that data is growing at a pace that is so rapid that is really adding all of the big data, the solution, the answer, or maybe do we need to find a better way to define what kinds of information would provide an incremental additional help or additional insight into a particular matter. So, like I said, show causality, understanding the mechanism, you know, finding the explanation and the systematic structure of all of this information, so that we can compare it to the facts, to the timeline, to the stuff that we actually know and currently know very well, is the biggest challenge in integrating big data to this right now. So that's where I will start.
Well, Judge Facciola, first of all, I cannot wait for your next few presentations live. I'm sure you're going to have some great comments about this going forward, which will be, you know, entertaining and on point and interesting. But, you know, dealing just with, you know, even though you're helping me moderate, I wanted to ask you a question from a judicial perspective. You know, what does it mean potentially, you know, as a judge, if the data being used by the clients is missed by e-discovery tools? And, you know, how do you feel as a judge if the technology we're using cannot mine the data effectively, which companies are using, which may be important to a case?
Well, we can't have that. To show, as Gordon said, why we're always at least 3 years behind. In 206, with the Federal Rules Amendments, we grappled with accessibility of data. And we talked about accessible and reasonably accessible and online and all of that. And then under what circumstances the cost could be shifted. But the central premise of that analysis was that the data was available. If the data is not available, we are going to have to come up with a new judicial mechanism to try to figure out how to find it and allocate the costs of it. If a person has used this for the purpose of making sure that it cannot be discovered, then the judiciary better quickly find a way to do something about it and get it discovered. Because if it doesn't, it will assist the perpetration of a fraud. The Pew Research Council estimates that 61% of the people in America do not see anything wrong with taking the boss's data when they go to the new job. If those people are using these devices to hide that fact, and the courts don't do anything about it, they are not only assisting in the perpetration of a fraud, they are condoning an obstruction of justice. So the answer to your question is we better get cracking. We judges, former judges, we better get cracking and figuring this out and figuring out what in the name of the world we're going to do with it. Because if the way this is going, as a magistrate judge, I saw the use of these devices in criminal enterprises. But as they work their way over into more ordinary civil cases, I must say it's quite terrifying.
Your Honor, this is Sean Byrne, and I would add to that and say that, you know, the judges, by not doing anything about it when it's brought in front of them in the form of motion practice, are almost giving criminals a roadmap as to which methods the courts aren't going to do anything about.
Yeah, that's right. Sean, while I have you, are there any present solutions from the way in which the companies use these devices that would at least give us some hope that they may be able to be searched in a technology that we don't have yet, but that we someday will have?
Well, I think the questions, it lies in what the output is of the data. So we've covered big data, we've covered dark data, we've covered the dark internet and the Tor, peer-to-peer, communication networks of the world. And a really good analogy, if you think about it, is structured data. And on the Seventh Circuit pilot and a number of other jurisdictions around the country, sort of the default in dealing with structured data is reports. And one of the big reasons for that, the opposing party usually doesn't have a very expensive database system where they can reconstruct that data and read it in exactly the way that their opponent was reading it. And the objection that comes up most often to producing raw database fields is that I don't think you're going to output that data in the way it was meant to be outputted. And so, my favorite quote when thinking about structured data is from Mark Twain, and it's, there are lies, there are damn lies, and there are statistics. And you can make statistics really say whatever you want. And so the default is to say, let's take a look at the report. And usually the plaintiff's bar is the ones pushing back on this, saying, I think we can dive even deeper into the data and our analysis will be reliable. And then the challenge is convincing the court that, in fact, that exercise would be worthy use of time and money and resources.
Yeah.
From a judge's standpoint, did I state that correctly?
Yes, I think you did. You stated it perfectly.
Okay. So
this is Gordon Calhoun again. One of the things we also have to recognize is that the use of dark data, particularly the Tor environment and peer-to-peer, is most prevalent in the United States. We're about 3% of the world's population, and we occupy 20% of the dark internet space in terms of our users. So our people are using it 10 or more times as frequently as anybody else in the world. So it's not a hypothetical issue. The use is here, and the volume of the use is very high already.
You want to get scared? Watch the Edward Snowden documentary, which is just such a great movie. And politics aside, whatever you feel, how they went through the dialogue and communicating using these tools to try to avoid each other. It's amazing. The efforts, very smart people can go to try to stay undetected.
On that point, Carl, we have to remember that the Tor, the Onion network, or the Onion router, was created by the United States Naval Intelligence to allow dissidents in repressive regimes to communicate freely. It's since been hijacked, in effect, by criminal enterprises. But the same folks who are responsible for NAS security in the web are also responsible for Tor, which is now a terrific device for people to operate literally under the radar and engage in nefarious activities if they're so inclined.
Well, I want to jump back in and finish answering Judge Fasciola's question.
Okay.
So if you take the structured data analogy and you agree on an acceptable output that helps tell a story in a reliable fashion, you take a look at what other solutions are out there. One thing that Nuix has developed are ways to tell a story about incident response and data breach in the cybersecurity community. Because in our view, not only do you need to be able to respond to that very quickly, but today's breach is tomorrow's lawsuit. And so we've developed visualizations that will allow you to take data that was typically considered inaccessible or of low value, like network intrusion logs or server logs, and be able to combine them to tell a story, tell a story about who had access to that network, when they had access, what they accessed, and when they left. And that is, I think, a good example of somebody coming up with a solution to telling a story that previously wasn't being told.
So I guess we just need more better communication from lawyers to the technology community about, hey, this is the bad dream I had. You know, what, you know, are there solutions, you know, get the word out so that the vendors aren't doing this in a vacuum, just coming up with bells and whistles that aren't going to be used. But I'm not sure how we do that, but, you know, we'll certainly promote this show and see what people do. Gordon, hey, I wanted to ask about the lawyers here. We've spent 4 years, by my count, trying to explain predictive coding, which is really just basically a spam filter, and we're just now starting to get traction. And in fact, I'd like to say, at Legal Tech, I thought there was one of the better presentations I've seen. You know, at times I've had my moments of disagreement with my good friends Maura and Gordon Cormack, and they actually presented their data in a way in which they acknowledge there are other ways with different types of collections. So I think even the experts are starting to get to the point where we're not going to confuse people in different ways. There are lots of ways. So I think we're making really good progress in terms of getting the message out. But do you think lawyers are going to be able to function trying to understand data flow and the types of data our tools might miss completely? Or are we really in a world where we're just going to have to find people like Jock to come explain this area because it's just evolving too quickly and it's just too technical?
Well, I think the answer is in both the ABA model rules and in the California ethics opinions that have just been issued on e-discovery, and essentially they take three approaches. You can either become an expert yourself, which is a difficult, time-consuming enterprise. You can associate with experts like Jacques to assist you with your case, or you can decline the engagement. Well, every case is going to use some form of electronic data, so declining engagements is not a realistic option. So really what we have to do for the near term is rely on people like Jacques, have not just an e-discovery vendor, but a data scientist on speed dial to address situations where there may be unconventional forms of data, unconventional only in the sense that we lawyers are used to working in a Microsoft world where our documents are all Word documents, email, PowerPoint, spreadsheets, and perhaps the odd database. Once we get beyond that, and you're going to be in that situation anytime you're talking about misappropriation of data or data breach environment situations, that's where you've got to have a cadre of experts at your beck and call until such time as you become conversant with the issues yourself. So, yes, it's going to be impossible for the average lawyer to master both technology and the legal side of the issues.
You know, if you're a technologist lawyer and you're listening to this show, I'll just throw out something I've done in the past that I enjoy doing. Personally, I get bored talking to lawyers all the time, so I try to do as much in my social life outside of the legal community. And I love working with lawyers professionally, don't get me wrong. It's a nice mix, but too much of one thing is usually not great. But, you know, I hang out at Carnegie Mellon, and I've got lots of friends who are computer scientists, and I tell them what we're doing, and I ask what they're doing. And the most amazing thing about that, in addition to learning, is you hear how many people are doing really cool things with technology that are nowhere near law. It's a great way to open up your mind to the opportunities that are out there to realize what might be something that, you know, applies down the line. Because this is what companies are investing in. These people are in super high demand to get companies, you know, mining data and using data appropriately. So just a suggestion. But anyway.
I wanted to, this is Jacques, to chime back in and echo on some of the things you've all said, starting with Sean. NOAICS has done a great job of taking in the cyber security and incident response, by building some new product. What I found very interesting about it is that their approach comes from an investigative approach, methodology, and that's very similar to what a data scientist might do. When you initially get a lot of data, you want to figure out what that data is about. So we use exploratory data analysis technique, maybe using charting or graphing, building graph to see if we can identify clusters or pattern, and try to then dig further into the data. That's some of the things that we're seeing, in the NOAIC, in tools like the NOAIC platform and other things. Then moving forward, you really need to have now someone who is very familiar with the story and what the facts are. In this case, the attorney or people that are very familiar with the issue at hand. When we look at this approach, I would almost say that it's very similar to the approach that we're currently employing or using in predictive coding matters, for instance. So, somebody has to get the broader line of the data, the broader shape, where things are. And someone has to be very intimately familiar with the issues and what we're trying to show, what we're trying to prove, what we're looking for. And together they try to, hone in on the information, the piece of information that would be most useful to the data. There are there isn't a tool out there to look at all types of data in all kinds of situations. But I'm seeing more and more in various pieces of software, in various e-discovery software or cyber forensic software, features that are helping discover and look at different type of information, and that's very encouraging.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we think about in our development is the amount of file types, the variety that Gordon was expressing, the amount of file types that we can read, whether or not we have a current visualization for them or not. We try to make sure that we can read as many as we can and that, as few exceptions pop up in our reports as possible. And then, the scaling of a solution is very important as well, because as Gordon pointed out, I think the volume is a big issue. And so, a lot of these file types are going to be very voluminous that you need to bring in order to build a visualization around it. And so you need to have a solution that is able to keep up with that.
So I think we answered the next question we were going to ask, but I had a follow-up in there about, in the last show we did a show with Sophisticated E-Discovery Council, really explaining why they add value in cases. And this is just another topic, who's going to be most aware of these risks, but the lawyers that are charged internally with tracking, new developments and at least knowing, like an orchestra conductor person, that, oh, I'm going to need a trombone now, or I'm going to need, I'm going to need a toolkit. But I'm curious about the judges here. And I wanted to ask you, a question as a judge, is this something, that you would find, given how new it is, it's something that is possibly sanctionable for missing data and not even producing it.
I really don't know. As I said, we focused in the 206 amendments on accessible to and non-accessible, or not reasonably accessible, I should say. Now, after December 1st of this year, we'll be focusing on relevant to a claim of defense and proportionality. So the given premise of that analysis is that the data is available, but it's going to cost X amount of dollars to get it. If it's not available at all under the new Rule 37E, if I was going to use one of the nuclear options of dismissing the case or instructing the jury to draw an adverse inference, under the rule, I have to find that there was an intentional act that had as its purpose the destruction of the information to keep it from the other side. Now, I'd have to think about that in the context of these cases. If the purpose of using these devices is not nefarious at its inception, if they were not designed to prevent access to the information, but for other purposes, they may not fit within that rule. So believe me, that's going to be a very complicated issue. By the same token, as I just mentioned, be aware that this is not as new to judges as you may think, because on the criminal side of our docket, we have seen how this underworld came into existence, a dark world where credit cards are exchanged or forged documents are exchanged. So we've been, you know, prosecuting, we've been involved in the prosecution of people like that for a decade. So this is not exactly going to knock judges out of their seats. But in terms of applying that in a civil context, that's where there's going to be a very exciting and interesting challenge.
So, Chuck, I'm going to add something. Oh, go ahead. Go ahead if you want to add something.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask the judge a question, Your Honor. Let me give you a hypothetical. So you've got a company that's performing sentiment analysis on its employees' emails. At some point, let's take a very extreme situation, somebody injures somebody or shoots up the workplace. And the company knew or should have known, at least this is the plaintiff's argument, that particular employee was unstable, unhinged, upset about something. At what point does that become relevant? And again, going back to... Pardon me?
No, go ahead, please. I interrupted you. Excuse me.
At what point does that become relevant? And then do you give access to the raw data files, or do you limit it, like my example before, to structured data, to the output of what the company would have read that would have led them to believe that this employee needed more monitoring?
I think the answer to both of your questions is yes. Yes, it is relevant from the inception, because the theory of liability was that you knew it failed to prevent. The second question, if there is data that bears on the quantum of your knowledge, it must be produced, and you must have it. If you created a system by which the information was created, and simultaneously with that there was an effort, technological or otherwise, to destroy it, I think that destruction will be held against you by most judges. I mean, we are learning now to our horror, aren't we, that the FBI did not get back to the state agency in South Carolina the fact that the guy who killed 9 people in the church had a disqualifying conviction and should not have gotten the gun permit. So I think we're all learning that in a world where data is flows so quickly from person to person, you are going to be held to account if you fail to be aware of it and if you fail to judge it. The systems you talk about where companies are using data to analyze, I think one company uses it to analyze who will leave and so forth and so on. They may be very valid devices, but they bring in their wake some very significant legal consequences. And I know to my horror reading of how the state authorities were not made aware of, because there was a glitch in the system, of the fact that this guy had a disqualifying conviction. It was just heartbreaking.
I mean, that's one thing Jacques had brought up about investigations and our focus on investigations. And, you know, we try and let, you know, our different groups sort of the best practices from each group inform each other. And one thing that's been particularly helpful from an e-discovery standpoint is, you know, really doing a lot of mind share with our investigative group and how do you connect dots and what ways are we not thinking about as an e-discovery community to connect those dots? And, you know, we've been making a lot of advances in that regard, especially on our ECA platform.
And again, judges are not unfamiliar with that process. You've got a whole flock of judges who sit on the Foreign Intelligence Service Act court who have been familiar with this for years. You have magistrate judges issuing warrants in terms of dark data and stolen documents. So judges are sensitive to this, and I don't think they're going to be as surprised as you might think they will be when it occurs.
I just want to say what a great panel this is, and, you know, I'm a horrible dancer, but I'm trying not to step on people's toes, because everyone's got good points to add, and so keep throwing them in there. And, you know, the question I was going to ask sort of as a follow-up to Jacques, and I wanted to add a new part, because I thought Judge Facciola made a really good point in one of his answers a few minutes ago, and it's actually the same point that came out at Legal Tech. So the first part of the question is, you're a technologist, you're a consultant who helps with these messy data-driven challenges. You've talked a little bit about ways to get at this data, that, you know, if it exists. But is this expensive to do this? Because I want to stop and talk about proportionality. And I'm not asking if you, Jock, are real expensive, because clearly you are a very skilled person, you know, with your knowledge set. But when you look at the complete package of what you have to bring to bear, maybe the additional tools, are we getting into a situation where maybe inaccessibility becomes something that is more real, even though the data is there? Because it's expensive.
Well, not necessarily. It depends of the type of what the objectives are. You know, the example that Sean mentioned earlier, you have a company that was performing sentiment analysis on its employee. Maybe the employee has resigned, or there's an issue, a legal issue, or potential risk of a legal issue, and they just want to know where they stand. You know, what did we actually know? When did we learn this stuff? And what kind of information do we have? It will be done within the realm and within the scope of a standard and typical e-discovery. The issue really comes when you're trying to extract or get the type of data that cannot even be handled or managed by a system or a review platform. An example here is we worked on a project not too long ago where we had to search for items that were not. It's actually something that's coming more and more in search engine and platforms. We had to essentially create new entities. With new entities, search entities would be like telling your search engine that you're looking for cars or for automobiles, and when you put that, it will return it. So if you're looking for credit card fraud, you will tell the system what a credit card fraud means, and it will look for that. So if you have to design a custom entity search, a custom entity search definition and things like that, when you go into having to create those things, yes, it can come out of the realm of accessibility. But for the typical, did we know about this employee's state of mind? What did we do? How did we collect the information? There's a lot of tools that we have out there that can help us start that conversation between, one of the techniques I like to use a lot is topic modeling, looking at everything we have, trying to see what are the various topics mentioned in our data corpus data collection, and then hone in on those topics that may be of interest. And within that, you can find maybe there are chat, maybe there are text messages, maybe there is voicemail and other things. And to deal with that kind of information, there definitely are tools in the marketplace to do that. So it really depends on what we're trying to do and the type of answers we're trying to get. Sorry,
okay, I'm glad. Sorry, yeah.
I'm drawing back the depends answer, but that's really what it is.
Well, I'm glad you're saying that, because I can tell you the reaction I heard from the audience in legal tech was the minute the word proportionality came out, everyone breathed a sigh of relief. And I get really nervous because having done a lot of these shows, I remember Judge Conte, in one of the shows in the past, said, I get people coming in with these estimates, and they're either it's going to cost the equivalent of sending people to the moon, or it's going to cost nothing. And, you know, I seldom get real numbers or analysis. But I see a good question Judge Facciola is going to ask to Gordon here, and I'm going to ask a preliminary question, sneaking in the middle here.
Carl, could I jump in there right before
Sure.
you ask the next question? Because I have something to address what Jock said.
Go ahead.
I absolutely agree with you, and I was waiting for somebody to use the word proportionality here. And yes, proportionality is going to stop a lot of the discovery of this information until economies of scale bring down the price of the solution to such a point where it becomes an affordable one, especially as data volumes grow, because you really are going to have to pick your discovery battles. We've got a tool that we use for to locate PII and sensitive data called Sensitive Data Finder that does exactly what Jacques says is talking about in terms of looking for named entities and regular expressions in the data. And we just do light metadata scans, so we don't even have to index the data to figure out which sources need to be looked at and potentially collected from and processed. When we talk about proportionality, there are solutions that actually exist on the marketplace today that can make, you know, something like credit card fraud and doing an in-depth analysis of what credit card numbers or other PII was released out into the public or stolen either through a cyber breach or from some sort of other insider threat, that's actually in the realm of affordability now.
Okay, that's good. So before Judge Facciola asks you your question, Gordon, I wanted to ask, do you think this becomes now part of the standard 30B6 deposition up front, that a lawyer has to start asking questions about, you know, the forms of data that are, you know, being grabbed and mined, you know, depending on the case, so that you can make an assessment? Are you going to have to go after that? Is, you know?
Well, I'd move it back to the 26F conference. Those conversations ought to start early and occur often, and people ought to be looking early on to get the court's assistance, because obviously if you have a suspected trade secret theft situation, it's highly likely that sophisticated people are going to have used non-standard ways of communicating. They're not necessarily going to send the company secrets they're misappropriating by Gmail. And if you have evidence that data was misappropriated, and that's usually hard to cover up, the questions need to be asked, what methods of communication were your clients using? And obviously, if it becomes apparent later that a peer-to-peer or darknet type of solution was employed and not disclosed, those are issues the court needs to be alerted to early, so that when the information comes out, appropriate measures can be taken either to compel production of the withheld data or take alternative punitive measures with respect to the basically corruption of the justice process. So if counsel aren't aware of the issues and aren't teeing it up and identifying it in the Rule 16 conference and part of the case management order, they're falling below what should be an acceptable standard of care in terms of representing their clients.
Well, Gordon, doesn't that have an implication then that information needs to be collected and assessed earlier in the process before the 26F conference? And I'll give you an example. When we're dealing with trade secrets, that's a lot of what a lot of our clients see is that these conversations hop around from channel to channel. It could be an email, then a text, then a Skype, then possibly a video or a voice message. And if you can look at that in a timeline view, and then you have some server files where somebody accessed Tor, even though you can't really read what happened, you can start telling a story to the court that the court can latch onto to say, yes, there looks like there is something here, that we've got these files that say that this conversation was happening, and then in this critical time period in the middle of this conversation, there were these server, access logs, and we can only assume that that conversation got even more in depth and free once they knew the prying eyes weren't upon them.
Well, I think your point's well taken. I'm not sure that it needs to be collection of the data. I think we can do a lot of the analysis that you just described in place, looking at metadata, doing things that the NSA does as opposed to listening to the text of conversations. I don't think we need to do collection, but there needs to be thought about identification and understanding what the data sets look like. And that means lawyers have to actually go out and get their fingernails dirty talking to clients, and not just the IT people. They need to get down in the nitty-gritty talking to custodians about how they actually use the corporate systems, because one of the biggest problems we run into is a system is designed to work one way, and people actually use it in different or multiple ways. And data is often in places where we don't expect it, despite the best efforts of IT and information governance people to try and put a corral around it. So, yes, lawyers are going to have to get involved and get involved early, but I don't think we need to go all the way to collection or pre-processing to have those conversations.
Hey,
go ahead. I'm sorry. You would agree, though, that at a bare minimum, in-depth custodial conversations and light metadata scans are probably appropriate to have a story to tell to the court and a discussion to have with opposing counsel about where data might or might not live.
Absolutely. And failure to do that is really a no-no. It's going to increase the cost of the litigation, perhaps exponentially. And the concept you talked about was something I was talking about yesterday with a CEO and technologist of another company about creating those timelines with a different text, email, and other forms of communication automatically early on, and often using just the metadata so that we'd know that conversations occurred. We wouldn't have to know what the content is yet, but we would be able to demonstrate to a court opposing that the parties were involved in communication, and therefore it's essential to have those communications captured.
You know, I this strays a little bit, but this has been such a good show thus far. I just want to say that at this point, that I, you know, anytime a nugget of good advice comes out, I want to highlight it. I think, Gordon, what you're saying about actually going out and meeting the client, I had a discussion with a lawyer, Jennifer Mason's her name, from Clark Hill Thorpe Reed, and I was asking her about, you know, how, you know, what I do, review, fits in with what she does, and isn't there a tension on economics, et cetera, et cetera. And she said no, because her value in the case is she absolutely leaves her office and goes and meets with clients at their location and asks the types of questions you're talking about, because then she understands the case and she becomes very indispensable. And that's all billable time. But it's the crux of trying to figure out how you're going to do the case. And my sense is there's so many lawyers out there that send their IT staff out to just, or their vendor, just go pull the data. And they've missed an opportunity to really get their arms around the case and develop a relationship with the client, an indispensable relationship. So I'm just throwing that out there because it was just such a good point. I haven't done a show on it. I don't think I could do a show on it, but I just wanted to recognize it. All right, Judge, I've been leading you up for your question number 7 here, so go ahead, let her rip.
Well, I think Gordon has spoken to it, and in the interest of time, the follow-up, Gordon, would be, as I think maybe you have already answered this, but there comes a time where the lawyers have not done this, and it turns out, in a way that almost seems to always happen, that the information comes out in another source, and then a malpractice action is brought against the lawyers. And you are called as an expert witness, and let's say you're in California and you're using as your basic text the recent opinion by the Board of Ethics out there about competence. Does a lawyer who doesn't familiarize himself with all these other sources of data, is that lawyer doing the job that that ethics opinion suggests he or she must do?
Well, I would agree that the individual in that situation, in the hypothetical that the state bar dealt with, has fallen woefully below the standard of care. And the problem really is that for many, many attorneys, they aren't even aware of the issue, much less that it was something they were required to address. And that's the real education problem that we face in this sector. People are still throwing requests to produce to the client and say, send me the stuff that's responsive and I'll forward it to the other side. And it's been clear for 15 years now that lawyers are jointly responsible with their clients to make sure that the appropriate data is not only preserved but presented for a fair adjudication, and we still have an awful lot of the carryover from the old paper days when it was possible for a client to go to a file cabinet and pull the 16 file folders that were probably the relevant data. Data has exploded since then, and our notions as a community, the legal community, really hasn't caught up with that. Yes, we use Google. Yes, we're on the internet, but we haven't got it in our DNA or in our gut yet that data has proliferated. The forms in which it exists is massive, and we have to take responsibility for understanding and managing that. And that's a really hard lesson for most lawyers, particularly those my age who grew up in a paper world, to really get their heads around.
That's certainly true.
Well, yeah. So, Chuck, you know, anyone that's looked at data flow through systems knows we miss data all the time. We get exceptions in processing, stuff, you know, doesn't flow through the right way. And I also remember a conversation that I never got to follow up with a computer scientist at the advent of predictive coding, who told me about data that just sometimes disappears. It's just gone. No one's quite sure what happened to it, but it left. So, you know, I never got an explanation on why that happened. But, you know, my question is, you know, so we have another form of data here. What's the big deal? Isn't the system still going to continue to work? I mean, we have lots of data to try to get the case figured out.
No, we're actually talking about the kinds of data that you don't have a reference to or evidence of in all the current data sources that you're currently mining. If somebody has been using onion rings to sell or to exchange credit card information and cost, or downloading code that caused a company to network to collapse, you will not have all the traces of that action in looking at the typical source of information, looking at his corporate email, looking at his laptop. And it'll be very difficult to show causality. It'll be very difficult to establish that this person did something. So it's important to get to figure out how we are going to incorporate these type of sources. There is always, I mean, an attorney told me before that the e-discovery process has to be a reasonable process, and then have many lawyers and have various team judges on the call. And so if I'm wrong, you tell me. From typically and purely a scientific approach, what we want to show when we want to implement a process, we want to ensure that that process is repeatable, that that process uses theories, methods that other scientists, other people can agree to, you know, not some new theories, nothing put out of a hat. And that is something that can be proven if asked to prove. Now, if the entire scientific community at some point agreed that the world was flat, and now we know that it isn't, so it's very likely that, you know, maybe further down the road, you know, years from now, months from now, I don't know, that a theory that was used, that was well agreed to by all the major brains, is no longer valid. But as far as data and all the data that's there, I always make sure that we use techniques and methods that are widely accepted and well documented, and that we use a process that can be repeated to show any outcomes. What you will see actually when you look at what's implemented in most of the software packages is that nobody is really going out and creating their own algorithm, their own out of the hat something. It's always based on theories that have been well vetted in the scientific community, maybe used in different industry first, and then are now applied to the to mining, text analytics, and e-discovery. I hope I answered your question.
Yeah. No. Yeah. So I see two questions left, and I think we've answered parts of them. Judge, you're the judge, so you can decide how much of this you want to ask.
No, I think we've answered both of them quite well. The only final thought I had would be in terms of educating the bar and the bench. Do any of our panelists have any suggestions as to how to understand this a little better than they do? Are there books or video presentations or podcasts, for that matter, that might help them understand how this dark data comes into existence?
Well, I would answer that question almost with a question, and that is, if a network, an onion network like Tor, as an example, exists, and it's primary purpose is to anonymize the users and shield outsiders from the conversation, isn't just the mere use of it, especially within a corporate environment where that is not a normally business-sanctioned tool, isn't that enough to give rise to an adverse inference by itself? And then shouldn't we let the other parties then argue why it shouldn't be an aberrance inference and give us the path to actually get the data that we need?
I certainly think that's a responsible way of looking at it, of course.
Well, I can tell you I will do everything I can to get this show distributed and tell people to redistribute it and retweet it and get the word out, because I personally think this is a top five show of shows we've ever done. I think it's just been I've been on the edge of my seat listening to this. So I think you guys have all done a great job in teaching me something. you never want to say you're never going to learn something new in e-discovery. You know, this taught me a lot that I hadn't really thought about deeply. So I think it's great.
One final comment, Carl. To answer the judge's question, how do we find out? Actually, one of the easiest ways to find out is to go to the internet and search on those terms. Wikipedia is going to give you some pretty quick and easy explanations. The footnotes in those sources will lead you to other places, and many of the articles on this topic contain bibliographies, which would be very informative if one needs to dive deeper than simply understanding that it exists.
So you're saying dark data. What would be the other terms that you would say to just throw out there and jump?
Try dark internet. Try the onion router. Any of those will...
Tor,
that's the onion router. Shorthand for the onion router, the acronym. So any of those generic terms will pull up literally hundreds of responses, and even if you look at only the first 15 or 20, you'll get an excellent bibliography for further research.
Isn't it fascinating that we're having this podcast on the very day that an object created by a human being is now a billion miles away and will begin to send back information?
A satellite that is very much in the dark right now.
Yeah.
Now you're getting really deep. I'm jet lagged still from San Francisco.
No,
I don't want to hear
it. The point I'm trying to make is there's always a tendency to think about, you know, how the glass is half empty. It's also half full. Technology may have the hope of bringing us information that in an efficient and cost efficient way that we have no idea even exists. It's an astonishing position for a human being to be in.
Well, Your Honor, I agree with that, and I would simply say that business intelligence is another term that judges ought to search. You know, there's all sorts of statistics out there.
Yeah.
One of them that I've seen is that 30% of all corporate quote unquote dark or unused data is mined or is capable of being mined for business intelligence. And I think as the judges become more educated and more aware of how that information is or can be leveraged, then they can be thinking along with the litigants about, you know, how do we use this information to tell a story?
Yes, that was my point.
Well, on that note, I want to thank Gordon, Sean, and Jacques for joining Judge Facciola and myself on this ESI Bites program, this discussion. It's if any of the listeners have any questions about this show or any other program at ESI Bites or ideas for shows, feel free to email me at kas@reviewless.com. I'd like to thank our sponsor, Jurnov, for their continued support of ESI Bites. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed the podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our show. And as always, we say, come to ESI Bites, learn more about eDiscovery before ESI Bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day.